Hello, and welcome to another episode of A-Minder. I'm Ellen Rowe, and I'm back to fill you in on everything that happened in the field of vascular contributions to Alzheimer's disease in October 2022. I know we're still a few months behind, but we skipped the September series to try to catch up a bit. We've got 13 papers to cover this month, with a mix of clinical and preclinical studies, hoping to better understand the relationship between amyloid accumulation and vascular function. We've got more on white matter hyperintensities, and some interesting developments on the therapeutic end. Stay tuned to learn more about how blood vessel health is implicated in Alzheimer's disease, and for disease perspective, a bit more lively than the classic amyloid cascade hypothesis.
Welcome to A-Minder, a podcast where we summarize the latest publications on Alzheimer's disease for you, so you can spend more time doing awesome research. For every month, you'll find a series of episodes by theme, and each comes with a bibliography. Whether you're in the lab, on the bus, or cooking your meal, we hope you find this podcast useful and accessible.
All right, thanks for tuning in, everyone. As always, I'll kick things off with some context of the episode for the new listeners, so go ahead and skip ahead if you're already familiar with this landscape of research, or if you're not new here. The brain is one of the most highly vascularized organs, with no more than a hair's width between any neuron and its closest blood vessel. As you likely know, or can infer from that fact, the cerebrovasculature is critical in keeping the brain healthy and functional. It plays a lot of key roles, like being the highway of nutrient and oxygen delivery to the brain, it's a main route of waste disposal, including amyloid clearance, and its highly selective blood-brain barrier is critical to keep blood proteins, pathogens, and immune cells out of the brain. When these functions are compromised, like when there is reduced blood flow to the brain, or when the blood-brain barrier is compromised, this can lead to metabolic stress and inflammatory cascades. So really, the blood vessels may actually be responsible for some of the initiating events in the Alzheimer's pathology. As a field, we're starting to appreciate that vascular dysfunction is an early event in the Alzheimer's pathology, as we see changes in cerebral blood flow and loss of blood-brain barrier integrity with age, and with the main genetic risk factor for Alzheimer's disease, APOE4. As we tune into the importance of the vasculature in maintaining brain health, we're learning a lot about how things might go wrong through the course of developing AD, and how maintaining vascular health and function could be a new way of preventing or treating AD. So hopefully that got you hooked on the idea that we really should be paying attention to the blood vessels in the context of Alzheimer's disease. A few notes before I dive in, a reminder that A-Minder includes all papers from peer-reviewed journals for any given month, meaning that we don't exclude any based on our own perceived quality of the science or accuracy of the interpretations. We also mostly draw from the abstracts for the content of our episodes, so be sure to check out the full papers for more details, and really to make your own judgments on the quality of the science before you accept anything as fact. We provide free numbered bibliographies with our episodes that you can find in the show notes, so you can note down the numbers of the papers that pique your interest here, and track down the full manuscripts using our bibliography. And finally, to wrap up the housekeeping items, some common abbreviations you'll hear me use in today's episode are, of course, we have AD for Alzheimer's disease, which I think I've already used, A-beta, or just amyloid for amyloid beta, and BBB for blood-brain barrier. Any others, I'll define along the way. So with that covered, let's dive right in. We'll start things off here with a couple of papers focused on vascular implications of amyloid accumulation. Starting with paper number one, titled Increased Type 1 Interferon Signaling and Brain Endothelial Barrier Dysfunction in an Experimental Model of Alzheimer's Disease. This was published by first author Jenna and last author Remen from the University of Illinois in the USA in Scientific Reports. As you heard in the intro, or have already heard me ramble on about before if you've listened to more of my episodes, BBB dysfunction is a key pillar in the AD pathology. These authors agreed, and here they leveraged the common APP-PS1 amyloidosis mouse model to probe for mechanisms that lead to BBB dysfunction. Using female mice, they found that BBB permeability increased with aging in the regions with the highest amyloid burden. To better resolve what was happening at the level of the BBB, they bulk RNA sequenced the brain endothelial cells and identified interferon signaling as one of the most prominent upregulated pathways. Looking more closely at the cells with immunofluorescence and blotting, they found higher levels of IFIT2, which is made in response to interferons, and lower levels of VE-cadherin, a protein tethering endothelial cells together at the BBB. To validate these findings, they treated human brain endothelial cells with interferon beta and saw the same response of decreased VE cadherin along with other tight junction proteins. Going one step further, when they depleted type 1 interferon receptor from the cells, they found that this prevented barrier disruption and the loss of VE cadherin. So with this, they concluded that interferon signaling might contribute to amyloid-associated BBB breakdown in the context of AD. So sticking with how cerebrovascular function is associated with amyloid load, we have paper number 2, titled Cerebral Vasomotor Reactivity Across the Continuum of Subjective Cognitive Impairment, Amnesic Mild Cognitive Impairment, and Probable Alzheimer's Dementia, a Transcranial Doppler and PET MRI Study. This one's by first author Saka and last author Topkoglu, and it was a collaboration between groups in Turkey, published in the Journal of Cerebral Blood Flow and Metabolism. To better understand the causes and implications of cerebrovascular dysfunction in AD, this group looked at several different factors in 43 individuals across the AD clinical spectrum, so from subjective MCI all the way to AD. Specifically, they used a series of imaging techniques to measure cerebral vasomotor reactivity, cerebral blood flow, metabolic activity, amyloid load, cortical thickness, and white matter hyperintensities. They found that people with MCI or AD had reduced vasomotor reactivity as per the breath hold index compared to people with the less severe subjective cognitive impairment, and that this reduction was strongly associated with increased amyloid load. They also found that better vasomotor reactivity mapped with increased brain metabolism and blood flow. Overall, these results suggest a robust relationship between amyloid and cerebrovascular function. Alright, so now we'll shift gears a bit to focus on the glymphatic system. If this is the first time you're hearing of the glymphatic system, it's pretty much like the brain's version of a lymphatic system for fluid drainage, because the brain doesn't actually have its own lymphatic system. So based on what we understand about this system, which has mostly been through animal model experiments, brain waste wiggles along the basement membrane of blood vessels, while cerebrospinal fluid washes along the perivascular spaces to clear it. And importantly, in the context of Alzheimer's disease, this system seems to facilitate amyloid clearance. And I think that leads us pretty well into paper number 3, which is titled Blood Cerebrospinal Fluid Barrier Function Disturbance Can Be Followed by Amyloid Beta Accumulation. This one's by first author Suzuki and last author Igarashi from the University of Niigata in Japan, published in the Journal of Clinical Medicine. So here, to better understand amyloid clearance dysfunction in Alzheimer's disease, these authors focused on the blood cerebrospinal fluid barrier, an important site in the context of glymphatic drainage. They measured interstitial water flow using radio-labeled water PET scans as a surrogate for blood cerebrospinal fluid barrier function, building off of their previous work showing that flow decreased with age and decreased further in Alzheimer's disease. Here they wanted to know whether this decrease was a cause or effect of amyloid accumulation. So they used PET to monitor both amyloid accumulation and water dynamics in a cohort of 25 cognitively normal individuals at baseline and at 2 years follow-up. Neither measure significantly changed over the 2-year period, but 3 individuals had increases in amyloid load at the 2-year mark. Interestingly, these 3 individuals also had lower measures of interstitial water flow than the rest of the group at baseline and at 2 years. While more work with larger sample sizes and longer follow-up times is needed to confirm these findings, the data here suggests that glymphatic drainage disturbances precede amyloid accumulation, suggesting dysfunction of the blood cerebrospinal fluid barrier likely precedes the classic AD pathological hallmarks. So shaping up to be a pretty good story. Next up, we have a paper titled MRI Images Implicate Glymphatic Alterations Mediate Cognitive Dysfunction in AD. This one's paper number 4 by first author Sue and last author Ro, and it was a collaboration between groups in Taiwan published in Annals of Neurology. So as I mentioned, most of what we know about the glymphatic system is from animal research, and here the authors wanted to measure it directly in humans to see how it mapped with other features of AD. For this, they turned to diffusion tensor imaging and analyzed images along the perivascular space using a previously published technique to get an index score of glymphatic function called the ALPS index, presumably standing for along the perivascular space. The study included 37 individuals with AD and 13 controls who all had amyloid and tau PET data, structural MRI data, cognitive assessments, and diffusion tensor imaging done to calculate the ALPS index. They found that as the ALPS index increased, amyloid and tau load decreased, indicating that glymphatic drainage clears these pathological hallmarks from the brain. They also found that cognitive scores mapped with the ALPS index, where better glymphatic function related to better cognitive scores. Interestingly, they also found that the index was a significant mediator in the relationship between amyloid or tau load and cognitive dysfunction. There was also quite a bit of regional analysis done here, so definitely check out the full paper for more on that. Overall, though, the work suggests that the glymphatic system is key in the progression of AD, and the ALPS index may be a useful biomarker. To cap off the first half of this episode, I have a couple of stray papers that I've put into a category broadly called Other Clinical Studies. So the first one is paper number 5, titled Topographical Differences in White Matter Hyperintensity Burden and Cognition in Aging, MCI, and AD. This is by first author Kamal and last author Didar from McGill University in Canada, and it was published in Geroscience. So here we have another regional white matter hyperintensities paper with the goal of determining whether their distribution or abundance is different across clinical disease stages and whether they associate with cognitive decline. Importantly, this study leveraged longitudinal data over a maximum of 13 years from 1,573 individuals from the ADNI cohort who were either cognitively normal or were diagnosed with MCI or AD and deemed amyloid positive. Using linear mixed effects models, they found, unsurprisingly, that those with AD or MCI had more regional and overall white matter hyperintensities than the controls. They also found that white matter hyperintensity burden in all brain regions mapped with cognitive decline in controls and a steeper decline in those with MCI. Interestingly, though, in those with AD, the association was only in the temporal brain region. These results indicate that white matter damage is linked to cognitive decline in healthy aging and early disease stages, but less so in late AD stages where other pathological changes may have a greater impact on the decline. Next up is paper number 6, titled Integrated Analyses of Brain and Platelet Omics Reveal Their Common Altered and Driven Molecules in Alzheimer's Disease. This is by first author Yu and last author Wang, and it was a collaboration between groups in China, published in MedCom. So I was particularly excited about this one because a lot of my work now is focused on platelets, and I'm always looking for links to AD and other dementias. If it's been a while since biology class, platelets are the little buddies in your blood key to clot formation, and interestingly, they have all of the required cargo to make amyloid beta. This has really sparked a fair amount of research investigating them as peripheral biomarkers for amyloid production in the brain, and more broadly, AD. So here the authors wanted to better understand the link between platelets and what's going on in the brain. And as many researchers do these days, they turned to omics to gain some insight. They used a series of statistical approaches to integrate their previously published platelet omics data with publicly available brain omics data from AlzData. Combining the data, they found over 200 differentially expressed proteins in both the brain and platelets, of which 70% had consistent changes. Specifically, they found that the protein HMOX2, involved in tamping down oxidative stress and inflammation, was decreased, while serpina-3 was increased in both platelets and the brain. With this, the researchers proposed that these could potentially be valuable peripheral biomarkers and may be new targets for treatment. Unfortunately, the brain tissue and platelets analyzed here weren't from the same individuals, so it would still be interesting to see if these findings persist in matched specimens. And with that, we're nearly halfway through the papers from October 2022. So stay tuned for more on comorbidities, risk factors, and treatment avenues, all related to the vasculature.
Hey listeners, I'm here to let you know Aminder is recruiting. If you're interested in joining us, shoot us an email at aminderpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
Nearly 1 million older Canadians live with a form of dementia. This number is expected to double within 10 years, and sadly, no solutions exist yet to dramatically reduce these numbers. It has to stop. Research can help solve this problem. We are 350 researchers fully dedicated towards preventing and finding a cure to dementia, and to improve care to those living with dementia. We are the Canadian Consortium on Neurodegeneration and Aging. The solution to dementia could be closer than you think.
Okay, and we're back. Thanks for sticking with me. Let's jump right into the next segment on comorbidities and risk factors with paper number 7, titled Autonomic Dysfunction Impairs Baroreflex Function in an Alzheimer's Disease Animal Model, by first author Ellen and last author Ostrowski from the A.T. Still University of Health Sciences in the USA, and it was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. So you may have heard about orthostatic hypotension way back in my May 2021 episode. That was the first time I had heard of it, to be honest. But if not, it's a common condition in AD patients where their blood pressure drops when they stand up. As a little neuroscience 101 refresher, the autonomic nervous system is really the master regulator of blood pressure and heart rate, with the sympathetic branch increasing it and the parasympathetic branch decreasing it. Here, the authors wanted to understand why this condition develops in AD, and they focused on the autonomic nervous system in a streptozotocin-induced rat model of AD for some insight. Using a technique called femoral catheterization, they found that the heart rate of the streptozotocin-treated rats didn't increase as much as it should have in response to low blood pressure challenges, but it responded normally to high blood pressure challenges. They also found that the maximal sympathetic nerve activity was reduced in the rats, but that the autonomic, adrenergic, and muscarinic receptors in the heart were normal. Check out the paper for more details, but with these findings, they suggest that orthostatic hypotension may be linked to a damaged sympathetic nervous system in AD. Next up is paper number 8, titled In Vivo Detection of Neurofibrillary Tangles by 18F-MK-6240-PET-MR in Patients with Ischemic Stroke. This one's by first author Michels and last author Lemons from KU Leuven in Belgium, published in Neurology. It's fairly well established that a history of stroke increases the risk of developing AD, but it's not quite clear why, or really if it's solely a result of damaged blood vessels. As you could probably guess from the title here, the authors used a neurofibrillary tangle-specific PET tracer to monitor their distribution following stroke, hypothesizing that ischemia following stroke also feeds into tau hyperphosphorylation, which could lead to later on developing AD. They imaged 13 individuals 6 months following their first ischemic stroke and found that compared with 20 age-matched controls, the tracer signal was higher in the ischemic region affected by the stroke and gradually decreased in the surrounding tissue. These findings suggest that neurofibrillary tangles may form after stroke and spread in the brain. Super interesting study, in my opinion, and it'll be interesting to probe into this further with more mechanistic animal model studies. Alright, so on to paper number 9, a bit different but still related to risk factors and comorbidities. This one's titled Oral Environment and Cerebral Blood Flow in Patients with Neurodegenerative Dementia, a Comparison of Alzheimer-type Dementia and Dementia with Lewy Bodies. This one's by first author Inu and last author Manabe from Kanagawa Dental University in Japan, and it was published in Psychogeriatrics. So it's been a while since I've come across a paper linking oral health to AD. It seems that the P. gingivalis hypothesis of the etiology of AD has lost some steam. I remember back in 2019, everyone who knew I was doing Alzheimer's research sent me links to all sorts of pop science articles claiming that we had finally figured out the cause of Alzheimer's disease, which turned out to be a bacteria causing gingivitis, or more specifically, the proteins they secreted called gingipanes. These articles popped up everywhere after a science paper presented a pretty solid case for this new hypothesis, ultimately leading to a spin-off company called Cortexzyme that developed a drug to inhibit gingipanes, which they hoped would improve cognition in AD. Unfortunately, their phase 2-3 clinical trial in those with mild or moderate AD failed back in 2021, but I think they're still pressing on with the drug after some subgroup analyses showed promise. So sorry for that big tangent, I got like really wormholed into this field of research for a while. Anyway, we'll shift back to the paper here. So here the authors looked more broadly at the relationship between health of the mouth and brain function in 25 people with AD and 25 with dementia with Lewy bodies. They hypothesized that different neurodegenerative diseases may map with differences in the oral environment. Specifically, they measured number of teeth, gum health, and how well the people were able to chew, and looked for associations with cerebral blood flow. They found that in people with dementia with Lewy bodies, cerebral blood flow in some regions mapped with their ability to chew, but this was not the case in people with AD. They also found that the health of the gums correlated with cerebral blood flow in both groups, but especially in the group with Alzheimer's disease. These results highlight potential differences between these two disease types, but more research is required to understand this relationship and its implications. The whole gum health thing kind of goes with the P. gingivalis hypothesis, but of course, like I said, more research is needed. So we'll wrap up this section with paper number 10, titled Quantitative NMR-Based Lipoprotein Analysis Identifies Elevated HDL-4 and Triglycerides in the Serum of Alzheimer's Disease Patients. This one's by first author Barazzoni and last author Trautwin from the University Hospital of Tübingen in Germany, and it was published in the International Journal of Molecular Sciences. So with apolipoprotein E as the main genetic risk factor for late-onset AD, lipoprotein metabolism has been a focus of a lot of work in the field. Rather than just using the standard clinical measures of HDL cholesterol or LDL cholesterol, here the authors leveraged a quantitative NMR assay to quantify 112 different lipoprotein-related measures, including cholesterol, apolipoproteins, and triglycerides from different classes of lipoproteins. Their study included 161 individuals who were either cognitively healthy, had MCI or AD, and who had AD-CSF biomarkers measured. They noted some interesting sex-specific differences in the serum lipoprotein profiles, and found that increases in HDL-4 and measures of triglycerides in several lipoprotein species mapped with AD pathology. Be sure to check out the paper for all the details. They have a really great discussion on the different lipoprotein species and their sex-specific findings. Turns out it's not as straightforward as HDL equals good and LDL equals bad. There's a lot more to unpack in lipoprotein metabolism and how it relates to AD in its different clinical stages. As per usual, we'll cap off the episode with some treatment avenues. This brings us to paper number 11, titled Effect of Sacubitril Valsartan on Cognitive Impairment in Colchicine-Induced Alzheimer's Model in Rats. This is by first author Hamadi and last author Shams from the Alexandria University in Egypt, and it was published in Fundamental and Clinical Pharmacology. Okay, so let's start with the drug. Entresto is the brand name for the sacubitril-valsartan combination medication approved for use in heart failure. I've covered other angiotensin receptor blockers like valsartan in my other episodes, and there seems to be quite a bit of data suggesting they're beneficial in the context of AD risk reduction. Sacubitril, though, is a new one for me. It's a neprilysin inhibitor, and I've definitely talked about neprilysin before because it's an enzyme known for clearing amyloid beta. So with Entresto, we've got a bit of a paradox in terms of its impact on AD. Valsartan may be good, while sacubitril may increase amyloid load and be bad. But how do they act together? These authors wanted to tackle this question, and they leveraged a rat model to do so. They injected a chemical called colchicine straight into the ventricles of the rats, where it can induce hippocampal lesions similar to those seen in AD, and then administered the combo drug orally to test its effect. They also compared this group of rats to another group receiving only valsartan, which is thought to be protective. While the valsartan-only group fared better than the untreated controls, as has been shown in other studies, the sacubitril-valsartan combo drug worsened scores on behavioral tests and increased amyloid load, oxidative stress, and inflammation. These results highlight that the combination drug may have a negative impact on AD risk. But I would like to highlight that a clinical study called Perspective with nearly 600 individuals was also recently done to assess this risk in humans, and they found no difference between the valsartan only and the combo drug in terms of cognitive decline or amyloid load over the course of 3 years. Perhaps a longer follow-up time would have revealed some differences, but it doesn't seem like we need to immediately scrap Entresto due to increased AD risk. Next up is paper number 12, titled The Association Between Beta Blockers and Outcomes in Patients with Heart Failure and Concurrent Alzheimer's Disease and Related Dementias. This is by first author Gilstrap and last author Skinner, and it was a collaboration between groups in the USA published in the Journal of American Geriatric Society. More beta blockers. I think the last time I had one of these papers was back in my February 2022 episode, and if you missed that one, first I'll get you up to speed on beta blockers. This drug class is classically used in the context of hypertension or heart failure, but there has been discussion in the field about their potential use in AD as well. Beta blockers work by blocking the binding of norepinephrine and epinephrine to beta receptors, and it turns out that lowering norepinephrine can also improve glymphatic clearance. Back in February, a group from Denmark found that treatment with beta blockers that could cross the BBB, like propranolol, resulted in a lower risk of AD. Here, the authors studied a group of individuals with a condition called heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, which I'll just refer to as heart failure for simplicity. They identified over 350,000 patients with the condition, of which 12.7% also had an AD diagnosis. They found that all patients, with or without AD, who were treated with beta blockers had a lower risk of death within 90 days and 1 year after being hospitalized. The risk of death was also lower in those who continued taking beta blockers after being discharged from the hospital, compared with those who stopped. Again, these results point to a beneficial effect of beta blockers in the context of AD, though the authors did not directly compare the AD group on beta blockers to an AD control group. So we don't really know whether the drugs had an impact on AD specifically. And finally, on to our last paper of the episode, titled Feasibility, Safety, and Tolerability of Two Modalities of Plasma Exchange with Albumin Replacement to Treat Elderly Patients with Alzheimer's Disease in the AMBAR Study. This is by first author Boada and last author Paez, and it was a collaboration between groups in Spain and the USA, published in the Journal of Clinical Apheresis. To start here, I wanted to take some time to talk about the larger clinical study behind this feasibility study and its rationale. So AMBAR stands for Alzheimer's Management by Albumin Replacement, and this strategy was proposed based on the idea that there's a dynamic equilibrium between amyloid pools in the plasma and CSF. So we know that amyloid accumulates in the brain in AD, so perhaps if we could shift the equilibrium further to the plasma side, we could clear more A-beta and therefore manage AD. A-beta binds to albumin in plasma, so this group leveraged plasma exchange with albumin replacement to shift the equilibrium to amyloid clearance, where albumin packed with amyloid from the plasma is removed and replaced with new albumin ready to bind more A-beta. There are also other potentially positive effects of albumin replacement. As albumin circulates, it can become glycated or oxidized, which hampers its ability to transport small molecules important to vascular health, so replacement could restore these functions. Primary results from the phase 2b3 clinical trial that were published back in 2020 looked promising, but here the authors looked more deeply at the safety and feasibility of plasma exchange from the trial. The treatment regimen consisted of 6 weeks of weekly plasma exchange with albumin replacement, followed by monthly low-volume plasma exchange for a year. Patients were either given a sham treatment, low albumin with intravenous immunoglobulins, or high albumin with intravenous immunoglobulins, and the authors measured the frequency and type of adverse events. They found that adverse events were more common in the active treatment groups, but that the treatment regimen resulted in a similar rate of adverse events as other plasma exchange therapies. Overall, the authors concluded that this type of study is feasible and safe, indicating that further research may be done with this type of treatment. And with that, we're at the end of the episode. Hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed putting it together. If you did, we'd love if you subscribed to us and wrote us a review on whatever platform you're using to listen to us. This helps us reach more scientists like yourself to carry out our mission of keeping Alzheimer's research a well-oiled and informed machine. A reminder that we offer free bibliographies with all of our episodes so that you can track down the full papers that I've summarized here. You can find a link to all of our bibliographies in the episode notes. We release bibliographies for the topics that we don't currently cover with full episodes as well, like fluid biomarkers, so check those out as a resource to start your literature search. Also, we're releasing episodes Mondays and Wednesdays, so be sure to check those out for a range of other topics related to Alzheimer's disease. I'm also still working on that website, which will be the new home for everything A-Minder. No more bootleg Google Drive soon, so stay tuned for updates on our website launch. Huge thank you to the whole A-Minder team for bringing this project to life, and especially to our sorting team for their help in parsing out focused episodes like this one, my reviewer Cassie, the editor for this episode, Scott, our musician Anusha for writing the beautiful music that you hear in each episode, and our managers Sarah and Ellen Kosh, who keep A-Minder going strong. If you're interested in joining this wonderful team of ours, we're always recruiting. Send us an email with your CV and let us know what you're interested in helping with. You can also reach us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching A Minder Podcast. And of course, thank you, our listener, for tuning in. We hope you find this podcast useful and accessible. Bye for now.